KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in San Ramon.
Larkspur in Marin County.
Simpson Beach.
I live in Noe Valley in Nevada.
Coming up, tomorrow is World AIDS Day. We'll hear how a song helped a San Francisco teenager put the crisis in perspective. Then comedian Corinda Dobbins talks about the burden and the joy of making jokes in this challenging political moment.
That's not really what comics wish for, just horrible time so we can make fun of it. But since we're here, obviously we have to.
Then we'll learn the story behind this week's Audiograph mystery sound. And we'll share some of your thoughts about Interstate 880.
It's my hope that that is the first thing that will fall into the ocean.
Keep your hands on the wheel and don't touch that dial. Cross Currents is next. Tomorrow is World AIDS Day. The first one was held 30 years ago to give people a day to come together to fight the disease, support those who have it, and remember those who passed. More than 35 million people around the globe have died from HIV or AIDS, and more than 35 million people currently have the HIV virus. People recognize the day in different ways. Many will wear a red ribbon tomorrow, signifying HIV awareness. In San Francisco, former President Bill Clinton will deliver a keynote address at the National AIDS Memorial Grove in Golden Gate Park. And tonight, the Grove will be lit up with candles for a fundraising event. For our part, we wanted to recognize World AIDS Day through sound and music. Max Hing was a high schooler at George Washington High School in San Francisco back in 2004. He took part in a segment similar to KALW's My Mixtape. It's called That's My Song, and it happened with our friends from Out Loud Radio at Youth Radio. And we thought what he had to say expressed the feelings of many thinking about the AIDS crisis.
Hi, my name is Max Hing. I'm a 12th grader at George Washington High School, and I am a youth outreach worker and a member of our Gay Street Alliance at George Washington High School. My song, my favorite song, oh God. Well, right now it'd probably have to be David Bowie's Under Pressure with Queen, Freddie Mercury. No, it's just whenever I hear that song, it reminds me that the human race is in this world together. And it kind of reminds me of like the AIDS crisis and what happened to Freddie Mercury. He died of AIDS. And it also reminds me of my cousin's father, who was a gay man in the 1970s, and he wasn't out. When he did come out around that time, he was still a good father, but he was like a kid in a candy store, kind of, in the Castro, and not a lot of info was out about AIDS. I mean, it was considered the gay cancer, but they didn't not necessarily know what caused AIDS. And so he was having a lot of fun, and he contracted it, and he died later. And my cousin grew up without a father. And I always, you know, I always thought that if more people at that time, you know, cared about each other, even the, you know, the queer community, I just think if that they'd been more interested in it sooner and had informed the public, that maybe my cousin would still have her father here today. And that's what David Bowie's song reminds me of. Don't let our differences separate us, but unite us. You know, give love one more chance.
That was Max Hing, who recorded this when he was a senior at George Washington High School in San Francisco back in 2004. Max, we hope you're listening today. Thank you. That story was produced by Out Loud Radio at Youth Radio. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Comedian Corinda Dobbins is unapologetically political in her stand-up. She's opened for Hari Kondabolu, Trevor Noah, and toured with W. Kamau Bell. She also co-produces the political comedy show The Resistance a few times a month in Oakland. Corinda started performing 7 years ago, and she told KALW's Jen Chien about developing her voice in comedy.
I read that your first comedy performance was on a dare. So could you tell that story?
It was on a dare. One of my friends had asked me if she found an open mic, would I do comedy? And I said yes. And only because I never thought she would.
And where do you think that question came from? Did you make her laugh a lot?
Yeah, I'm kind of funny around my family. So they thought that I should take that public. So she found an open mic in Oakland, a place called Woody's. It's actually a cafe and a laundromat.
Classic launching pad.
Exactly. And I did about 10 minutes, I think, in my first open mic, which is kind of unheard of. Usually you do 2 to 3, I think. And I thought I was going to bomb and people were going to stop asking me to do stuff like that. But it went pretty well. So I said, let me see where I can go with this.
And how did you come up with 10 minutes of material for your first time? That does sound like a lot.
It was. I don't know if all of it was funny, but...
but enough of it was.
Yeah, I wrote for about 2 months, I think. So I wrote for a long time.
This is no ordinary dare.
I took it very seriously. I wanted to have material even if it wasn't going to be funny. I was like, because I didn't know how much time open micers get. You know, but I was the only person to sign up that night, and that never happens. It had never happened before. It has never happened since. They didn't know if I was good or bad because nobody was before me or after me.
Mm-hmm. You set your own rules.
I set my own boundaries.
I moved out here with my aunt, and one of her friends came down from Fremont, and she was getting her hair done. My aunt's like, let's go watch her get her weave done. I was like, okay, I'll go in. And so when I walked in, the lady was telling a story about how these three women had came into her shop and beat her up and put it on YouTube. And that's when my ghetto Spidey sense started going off. Danger, danger. And she was like, the trial start next week. I started giving my aunt like we got that thing. I was like, what thing? What thing? I was like, we got that thing that prevents us from being the sequel to that video.
So you said that you like to make your friends laugh. Were you also the funny one like in your family growing up?
I was one of 100 funny people in my family. I was maybe number 25th on the totem pole of funniness. We have a lot of great storytellers and funny people in my family. So, I mean, I think it's just sort of genetic, maybe. It just sort of passed down to me. So, and when I would tell stories and be funny when I was growing up, I didn't think it was special because so many people in my family were really funny. I was just like, oh, this is nothing
special.
This is just
what you do.
This is just, you know, what people do.
Yeah. And what do they think now of you forging this career path?
You know, I posted, I celebrated like my 7th year of comedy last March, and I posted, you know, that I've been in comedy for 7 years. And then my aunt posted, and she was like, "You've been a comic since you came out of the womb." So it's like other people are just now seeing it, but you've been a comic your whole life. So
supportive.
I think they already knew.
Before you, maybe.
Yes.
I also got to give a shout out to Glenn Beck for reclaiming the civil rights movement. He said that he could do that because the people who started the civil rights movement were his people. And by that, he meant they were Christians. And that's just like me saying the KKK was my people because the sheets they was wearing was all cotton. That really makes sense, though.
Your style is, not only are you going for laughs, but you also are, as the millennials say, woke. And you want to bring your audience along with you into that wokeness in terms of your politics and your social commentary. Do you think about that in a conscious way as you're making your material or when you think about yourself as a comedian and a public figure?
I think it's not really conscious for me. It's just the way I live my life. I was raised in a very sort of politically active family. And so to me, it's just day to day. You know what I mean? I just write about things that I'm concerned about and things that sort of are troubling to me in this day and age. So for me, it's just my point of view. And that's what they say you need as a comic, to have a strong point of view, you know? And people will follow you based on if they like your point of view or not. So mm-hmm. I just see things and I'm like, that could probably be funny. I mean, my number one job is to be funny. And everything else is sort of, you know, comes after that. But I feel like, you know, like Toni Morrison said, like, this is a time when artists are supposed to be the most productive and our voices are supposed to be the strongest. So
I feel like... In times of
trouble.
In the culture.
And so I feel like this is a time when comics, you know... they're going to need to laugh right now, so we need to, you know, step our game up.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that way personally about the difficult things that you talk about, like racism, sexism, homophobia? Does it help you personally to talk about that stuff, to make fun of it? And does it kind of make it easier to bear?
No. I remember when Donald Trump got elected and so many people were saying, you know, oh, this must be a great time for you because, you know, you get
it's
to make fun
material.
Of all these things. And I'm like... well, I don't necessarily want to have so many struggles in order to make it funny. It's like that's not really what comics wish for, just horrible times so we can make fun of it. You know, but since we're here, obviously we have to. I would rather have a president that I could make as much fun of if my life was going to be easier.
Right.
I would love to have a better life as a human than a better life as a comic. That's never a question.
That was comedian Corinda Dobbins talking with KALW's Jen Chien. You can catch Corinda on Friday at The Resistance at the New Parkway Theater in Oakland. Find more information at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KALW's Nina Gensler-Debs.
All week long, we've been playing you this sound.
If you didn't have the system, then you'd have to have somebody actually walk that blood to the lab.
Think you recognize that? We sent reporter Sarah Tan to the South Bay to learn more.
Buried deep in Stanford Hospital is a network that's a little more Jules Verne than Silicon Valley. 4 miles of pneumatic tubes run in between the floors and ceilings of the hospital. It's a suction-powered superhighway to move objects around the vast medical campus. A pneumatic tube system is a network of metal tubes that uses compressed air to transport items in capsules. You might have seen a smaller version of this delivering checks and cash at the drive-thru of your local bank.
Like this one I have in my hand, it's a biohazard capsule, and we label it as such.
Stanford System is one of the biggest and most efficient pneumatic tube networks in the country. It has a 99% success rate and delivers about 7,000 capsules per day. Marcus P. Koo, lead maintenance engineer, oversees the entire system.
The clinicians, or the nurse, the phlebotomist, whoever, they'll draw the blood from the patient, and then they'll stick it in this capsule to get it to clinical labs so they can do their analysis for the blood.
So blood samples, medications, small medical devices, and everything in between goes into the capsules. Breakable items get folded into a small plastic air pillow inside the capsule.
It's pretty heavy. It's like 3.5 pounds. It's all plastic. It has a fiber band around it, you know, that goes in a 6-inch tube.
In a place where high-tech reigns supreme, Stanford Hospital uses this slightly old-school, quirky system to get all small transferable hospital goods from point A to point B. Because the internet still can't do everything. If you worked here at the hospital, you'd put a capsule into a robotic-looking basket arm and send it on its way by pressing a number on a keypad. Then it gets suctioned up at 30 miles an hour, 45 feet in the air, all the way to the engine room on the roof, which is where Marcus takes me next.
This is the blower, and this is the device that creates the vacuum and the pressure.
This is the heart of the system. We're surrounded by metal tubes with capsules whizzing by. A super strong fan powers all of this. But it doesn't look like much, just a large metal box with tubes coming in and out with an exhaust pipe.
That was a capsule that just went speeding by. See, there's another one.
Cool. It's just like traffic up here.
After being sucked up to the roof, each capsule gets pushed back down into the bowels of the hospital, where it shoots out in a different location. Here's one popping out in the clinical lab, a high traffic station on the pneumatic network. All blood samples land in a nondescript cubby in the wall and roll down a carpeted chute. Lab techs check labels and perform whatever tests the doctors ordered on the capsule's contents. Susan Cabalbag uses the pneumatic tubes every day.
It's pretty cool. It's neat that you don't have to walk all the way from the other side of the hospital to drop something off.
If you didn't have the system, then you'd have to have somebody actually walk that blood or whatever to the lab, or like the medication from the pharmacy, walk it up to the patient. So you would have to actually deliver it, hand deliver. With this, it eliminates that.
Stanford's pneumatic network has a near-perfect success rate, but capsules still get lost sometimes. And when that happens, Marcus the engineer has to go find them.
I do a mad dash and try to find it, and I'll go get it myself.
Oh.
You know, okay. And I'll deliver it myself, so.
He's on his feet most of the time, just making sure the system is running smoothly.
When I do my rounds on the system, I average 7 miles a day.
The whole thing has a steampunk feel to it. This technology is straight out of the 90s, the 1890s, when pneumatic tubes were cutting edge. They were first used to deliver mail. In several East Coast cities, metal canisters of letters zoomed under streets to people's homes. But it was costly and inefficient, so it never quite caught on. The idea stuck around, though. More than a century later, Elon Musk is into pneumatics. You may have heard of Hyperloop, his proposal to transport people in a large vacuum-sealed tube from San Francisco to Los Angeles in under an hour. And pneumatic tubes are still being built in hospitals around the country. Leander Robinson is the former chief engineer at Stanford Hospital. He helped install its tube system in 1991. And what makes Stanford's system different from others, he says, is its success rate.
The care that the maintenance team puts into the system makes it perform at a higher efficiency rating than other facilities. And timing is everything.
The system costs Stanford millions of dollars to install and maintain, and they're still expanding it into newer buildings. Right now, the honor of the largest tube system goes to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. But when Stanford is done expanding, it may be a serious contender.
I've seen other hospitals that they don't send blood, they don't send any biologicals whatsoever because of the fear of breakage, the fear of it becoming lost. At Stanford, we sent everything. We send blood, we send urine, we send stool.
Bodily fluids, chemotherapy drugs, and lunch.
And people send their lunch through this sometimes?
I've seen somebody do it one time. It doesn't happen every day. I don't know why you would want to do that, though. Only because I know that, okay, you know, I've seen some urine spill in here, you know, that I had to clean. So I'm like, you're sending your lunch to this thing. Okay.
At least you know there's a 99% chance your lunch will arrive when and where you need it. In Stanford, I'm Sarah Tan for Cross Currents.
This week, a few of you got so close to the right answer. You got the pneumatic tubes, just not the right location. But don't worry, we'll have a brand new mystery sound soon. Also, if you know a place anywhere in the Bay Area that you think would make a good audiograph, get in touch. Email us at news@kalw.org.
Thanks, Nina. That's almost it for our show today, but before we go, we want to acknowledge some feedback we got on a story we aired last week. It was about Interstate 880. Now, several listeners took issue with us calling it the 880. They say that's not the NorCal way to say it, and that we should just call it 880. One listener even called it a, quote, corruption of our northern culture and must be rooted out at all costs, close quote. Okay, we hear you. We also heard from listener Lisa Rose, who talked about just how much she hates that freeway.
I heard your report today. My thought is that if there's any way we can do without it, it's my hope that that is the first thing that will fall into the ocean. I can't even begin to describe how painful that freeway is to me and how much I do to avoid it. When the big earthquake comes, if 880 goes, I will not be sad. Thanks.
Well, we love your thoughts and comments, so make sure to keep them coming. The Cross Currents team includes Marisol Medina Cadena, Angela Johnston, Stephen Short, Andrew Stelzer, Beau Walsh, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are Jackie Sajiko, Gabe Graben, and James Rollins. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Our news director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. It's that time of year when local choirs come together to lift their voices in song. The group you're listening to today is the Oakland Interfaith Gospel Choir. The choir sings their 32nd annual holiday concert at Oakland's Paramount Theater. That's on Saturday. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.